Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And that means the phone lines are wide open right now if you have any health-related questions at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-CFR. I encourage you to call right now. I want your take on something that Bob Chiarelli's office is working on, the Minister of Transport at Queen's Park, member for Ottawa West Nepean. It's being described as a reverse graduated licensing system for elderly drivers. Apparently, the province of Ontario is behind other jurisdictions in implementing this kind of regime. And there's data that they're quoting, the government is quoting, from a study from Queen's University that suggested between now and the next 15 years, the number of fully licensed drivers with dementia-like symptoms will increase with our elderly population to 100,000, that there will be 100,000 fully licensed drivers on the roads in Ontario between now and 15 years from now. They want a, quote, what they call a more rigorous training session for physicians to, I guess, intervene in this matter or what have you, if you see a patient with dementia who is still a licensed driver. And then they would essentially do what they do for new drivers, that depending on your faculties or what have you, you may not be allowed to drive at night, or you may not be able to drive on a 400 series highway like the Queensway. What's your take on this?
If you're going to determine whether someone is competent enough to drive, you do have to have a multiple disciplinary means of making that determination. So granted that levels of dementia can certainly impair driving, and if someone is found to be wanting in that area, then certainly that's something to report. But there are other instances where someone is older, but they have no evidence of dementia, but their reflexes may be slower. They may have certain practical skills that are now not necessarily impaired, but slowed. And so you have to have a means to assess that objectively. Not subjectively. No. Right now, you don't. As a physician, I'm not qualified to do that. I don't know how someone is driving out in the world. They need to be assessed at a center. There are driving centers, test centers. People go for training.
Yeah.
There are
there is some kind of system in place where elderly drivers have to take a test once they reach a certain age, I believe, and 120,000 people a year go through that system.
I can stand corrected on this, but I don't think that it involves any practical testing. I think it's a vision test and some other things, but nothing that really...
Knowledge of rules of the road, maybe.
Nothing that encompasses actually seeing someone drive their car, deal with obstacles, deal with the everyday things that you would see out on the street. That's what's needed. If you're going to assess people's ability to drive, you have to assess their ability to drive, and that not only includes their cognitive ability, but it also includes their practical ability. As with anything, any skill, you need to be able to test that and need to be able to test it realistically and have a set criteria for the test so that everybody has the same test. You can make good comparisons if you have evidence-based testing to determine whether someone is capable of driving. So it's not necessarily a person's age. It can also be on the basis of an illness somebody has. They have oxygen they need to carry around oxygen. They have other conditions that may impair their ability to drive, and you graduate their license on that basis. But you make it objective. You don't make it someone coming into an office and, oh, you look a little ill today, or you look like something's off today. I have to report you, because things change and things are in flux. So you need to have a more comprehensive set up for that, and we don't have that in this province. So before they start laying it on physicians to be able to recognize...
Essentially screen people, screening, I gather. Yeah.
Screening is only valuable if the tests that you're using to screen are sensitive, that is that they tell you something is true when it's true, and if they're very specific, that is they are when something is negative, it's negative. And cognitive testing only goes so far. You have to have much more practical approaches to this. So someone that comes in that's 70 years old, 70-year-old people are different, depends on what diseases they have. And if someone is driving very well, you do a test, and that 70-year-old may be able to drive at night, do everything a younger person may be able to do. And at the same time, there's another 70-year-old that may not be able to do that, but you have to have a means that is credible to do that. You can't just have an ad hoc approach to saying to someone, you can't drive, but I think you can drive.
Do you have the power as a physician to take away somebody's driver's license?
Yes, I do. If there is something that in their medical history that makes them a danger to drive or a danger to others, then yes, there is that power to do that. But you have
And
to
how be, does that work? What do you do?
It's usually a report to the Ministry of Transport.
So you fill out a report and you mail it to them?
You fax it to them. Okay. So it gets to them very quickly. And they make the determination about whether someone is able to drive on the basis of the information provided. So I'm not taking away their license. I'm reporting a concern that there's something in their medical history.
Right.
There's something.
But they would obviously follow your advice, your recommendation.
They would. What they would do is they would inform the person that their license is under suspension pending a review by a specialist or somebody that will deal with their disease process to determine whether it indeed is an impacting on their ability to drive.
Okay, let me ask you this to conclude on this topic. Do you support a graduated licensing system for drivers, elderly drivers, or drivers at risk of causing harm because they have dementia? Should there be a bureaucracy in place or a system in place to deal with those people?
You should have a streamlined system to deal with that as you would in evaluating any condition that somebody has. Just as if you were sick and you're doing a test to find out what the illness is to treat it, the same thing has to do with driving. If you have something that you suspect is going to impair driving, you have a systematic approach so that the person is aware that there are objective tests being done and they're not just being told by someone, you can't drive because I think you can't drive. It's you can't drive because here's all the evidence that shows that you either can't drive at night.
It has to be evidence-based.
It has to be evidence-based. Right. You can't just have it ad hoc. But I think I have written about this in the past because of what happened to my brother. And that is...
Your brother was struck by an elderly
driver. He was killed by an elderly driver when he was in the United States cycling. So it was a matter of this person not being competent to drive. But you can't paint everybody with the same brush on the basis of their age. You have to be able to objectively assess each person and have a system that works, not have a system where everybody is being reported because you suspect something is wrong.
Okay. Let's take some calls. Deborah in Spencerville.
Quick question. For the last couple of months, I've had a burning sensation going up and down my left leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Now, is it within the left leg, is it in a specific area?
It's kind of on my thigh and my outer thigh. And then sometimes it races down to just below the knee. But it, honest to goodness, it feels like it's on fire.
Okay. And it's just in that area. So if you were to go to the inside of the thigh, that wouldn't bother you
very much. Not often. Occasionally I get it on the inside, but it's mostly predominantly on my left leg, on the left side.
And how long has this been going on?
About 6 weeks.
Okay. What you're describing, and this is actually a very common call that we get because it's a very common condition. If you can map out, that is, if you were to, for example, take a pen and sort of go along and mark the areas on the thigh when you got to the border of where it felt burning and where it didn't, you probably would be mapping out an area that supplies of a nerve that supplies that area of the skin. That nerve is called the lateral cutaneous nerve of the thigh. And it's sometimes when it gets compressed or damaged, usually the usual way it gets damaged, you see this a lot in bus drivers and taxi drivers because they're sitting a lot during the day. The act of sitting actually compresses that nerve and they get that numbness or tingling on that outside area of the thigh. It's not a dangerous condition. It usually does resolve, but what has to be looked at are any factors. You know, it could have been 6 weeks ago, something that may have compressed the nerve. And usually then it takes sometimes months for the nerve to heal itself up. But the burning you're feeling, especially if it's so well localized, means it's a peripheral nerve. It's a branch. It's not a main nerve that's running down the leg. It's a branch coming off that main nerve that somehow has been compressed and is causing that sensation. But it usually does resolve over time.
Okay. Is there anything in particular just to help it out at all, and exercises? Or?
Usually you're looking at things where, again, avoiding sitting for a prolonged time, crossing the legs or sitting cross-legged probably wouldn't do that either.
Okay.
But otherwise, you just have to let this heal up. There's not much to do about it. It's almost similar to, you know, leaning on your elbow or falling asleep at night and waking up and finding that you can't move your arm because it's all you know, the nerve has been compressed and then it finally comes back with pins and needles.
Okay.
But this is very similar. But in this case, likely if it's continuing for 6 weeks, the nerve was damaged. And as long as that nerve was never cut, and it's not because you haven't had any traumatic injury to cut the nerve, it does grow back and does repair itself.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, let's take a quick call, and then we'll stop for the news. Jamie has an interesting question. Jamie in Carlton Place.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm just wondering, since the city of Ottawa is passing this no smoking in public, what are the true effects that secondhand smoke has on somebody standing 25, 30 feet away from me outdoors while I'm smoking my cigarette?
Probably not very much.
Then how?
Hey, look, I brought this up. There was actually an article in the National Post by an anti-smoking advocate who said that it has gone too far. That what is, although certainly you don't want people smoking in playgrounds because you don't want kids picking up cigarette butts, in terms of scientific evidence that smoking outdoors, sort of out in the market here, is somehow going to cause a problem when you have cars whizzing by spewing stuff out too.
Let me interject here. Because you know what? I think it, you know, whether there's evidence that it's bad or good or what have you.
Yeah.
It's good public health policy to limit smoking when you can, and restrict smoking and restrict access to cigarettes. Listen, I regret the very first day I ever sucked on a cigarette, okay? Take it from me. I've been smoking 25 years now. It's filthy. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult to quit.
Right.
But what bothers me about this is the duplicity, the cultural duplicity. The chief medical officer of health has come out and made it abundantly clear that smoking the shisha or anything else that they stick in these water pipes is bad.
Right.
It's bad. And yet the counselors, when they pass this bylaw, say we can't crack down on the shisha smoking because we don't have volumes of evidence
but
that it's bad for you.
But they don't have volumes of evidence that smoking outside on the street is going to cause harm either.
Right.
So say it for what it is. It's more of... It is not necessarily a health policy. It's just what they want to do, in terms of restricting.
Right. And in fact, those shisha parlors, you can get a license to open one of those.
So,
and you can puff away.
You know,
it's
if they want to pass a law, that's fine, but then say what they're actually doing. Don't couch it behind health policy when there isn't evidence that smoking, and the caller is absolutely right, smoking 25 feet away, it's not going to do anything to you. Let's face it. That's not going to hurt you.
All right. We have to stop here. The news coming up. And then after the news, we'll get to Nancy in Cantley, who unfortunately, I think, has a broken foot.
Bueller.
He's sick. My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
Whenever I start feeling sick, I just stop being sick and be awesome instead. True story.
Oh, my God. I gotta go to the emergency room.
Well, assuming you're correct that your right humerus is no longer seated in the glenoid socket, I would certainly think so.
Relax. Kids swallow quarters all the time.
Really?
Sure. If she craps out two dimes and a nickel, then you can start worrying.
3:42, Dr. Barry Dworkin is here, and we're going to Cantley and Nancy. Hello, Nancy.
Yes, hello.
Do you have a broken foot?
Yes, I broke my foot in the beginning of December, December 9th, and I'm still suffering from it. And I would like to talk to Dr. Dworkin about it.
Sure.
He's right here, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I broke my foot December 9th. It's a while ago, and it was a spiral break, small bone in the side of the foot above the joint of my baby toe.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I'm still, the x-rays are not showing healing or extremely slow healing.
Right.
And I have another appointment for an x-ray this Friday, and I'm wondering whether or not perhaps I might have to be looked at for osteoporosis.
That's a good question. How old are you, by the way?
I'm 51.
Usually when there's a fracture, it's usually fractures that you look at in the wrist or in the spine. obviously the hip as well. Those tend to be areas where if there's osteoporosis, it raises sort of a red flag, especially when if someone, you know, 51 years old falls and breaks their wrist, you sometimes want to find out the bone density. The issue then becomes whether this was the result of a specific trauma, because it's different if there's a fracture that occurs when there's sort of a light bump versus a fracture that occurs if someone really has done a number on their body and it causes a big impact. So how did you break the foot?
Well, I just slipped in my living room, loose sock, and my foot went sideways, and my whole body fell on the side of my foot. So
that'll do it.
Yeah, it did it really well.
It's a good. There are specific guidelines with regards to doing bone mineral densitometries or bone mineral densities. And that's put out by the Osteoporosis Society. There was a really good framework of guidelines that you would look to see what happens, how old someone is, whether they have a family history of osteoporosis, whether they've had any fractures that really were unexplained. Those kind of things would lead to bone density evaluations.
Right.
So on the basis of the one bone in that foot, which is a very common bone to break, that's usually it breaks around what's called the fifth metatarsal head. It's where the ligaments and the tendons attach to the bone on the side of the foot where the baby toe is, and it pulls on the bone sometimes and the bone will break or twist.
Yeah, it's looking like the when you look at the x-ray, you can see a shadow right through the whole length of the bone.
Yeah, and they may have to do more to that to try to put the bone together if it's not healing up the way it's supposed to.
It wasn't displaced. They checked it for displacement.
Right.
And I've had an x-ray January 31st, and it was still, from the x-ray from January 11th to the 31st, they looked almost identical.
Did they immobilize the foot? Have you had something to...
I had a removable cast on up until, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, and he told me I could walk. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of walking flat-footed right now. There's still soreness if I move or my foot's on uneven, anything uneven, it still hurts.
Yeah, bone pain in the foot is terrible. It just really, it just doesn't want to go away.
Yeah.
But
I'm just worried about when you look at the x-ray from, say, January 11th to January 31st, it almost looks like there's nothing happening.
Yeah, and that's where the orthopedic surgeon should be able to give you the answers, because it's not an area that I'm an expert in, so I don't want to mislead you in any way. But normally you would expect to see the bones start to show evidence of healing, and if it's not, they may have to propose things to try and get that bone to heal. They may want to watch a little bit longer, as long as you can move around. But really that's sort of something they're going to have to give you some idea about. With regards to the osteoporosis...
Mm-hmm.
On the basis of that fracture, I probably wouldn't do the bone density. It would be more along the lines of you would have to do that whole guideline evaluation in order to know whether that's necessary or not. And there's a bunch of stuff your physician would know about you in order to accurately determine whether you needed to have a bone density.
Yeah, I had a short conversation with my GP about that, and he didn't think.
Yeah,
it's because it was a trauma instead of a
that's exactly
something
it.
Minor.
I mean, your whole body fell on the foot. It's gonna break something.
I guess it's just frustrating that it's taking this long to heal, and my worry was, why is it taking so long?
And it may be that although the X-ray shows the bone close together, it may not be close enough for the bone to be healing the way it's supposed to.
What does that mean?
Sometimes it means it depends again. I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, so I mean sometimes they will pin a bone to try and get it to stay together in order for it to heal. But again, it's been a month, so I'm not sure if that's something that they do
a
month afterwards.
Yeah, 2.5 months now. Yeah. Okay. Well, I hopefully it will just heal.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're very
for
welcome,
that information.
Nancy. You're very welcome.
Good luck,
bye-bye.
Nancy.
Bye bye.
Let's go to Teresa in Ottawa. Go ahead, Teresa.
Yes, my daughter had a neck and shoulder injury some time back.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the tests that they did in order to investigate this was give her an MRI. Notwithstanding the injury of her neck and shoulder, something else also showed up on the MRI, that she had multiple, I don't know if they call them nodules or nodules, in and around her thyroid.
Okay.
Now, basically the doctor at that time said, oh, that's nothing. Don't worry about them. okay?
Okay.
However, one was a large size. In the meantime, she's been having trouble swallowing. She's been having trouble, having pain, and there is some swelling and stuff going around her outside of her neck now. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so she went back to the doctor on this, and the doctor immediately sent her for an ultrasound.
Okay.
Which she just had. And they discovered that there was even more there now, plus they're gotten larger, and one of them measured 6 millimeters, I think it was.
Right.
What? And also, they were listening for the sound of them. What would that mean?
Well, they're looking...
Is it something that that nobody should be concerned with?
Well, if you find thyroid nodules, this was found incidentally, but the fact that there's thyroid nodules mean that you should try and evaluate what those nodules are, whether they're just areas of scar tissue, whether
yeah,
they are...
Yeah, you would
whether
think so.
Or whether they're gross or not.
Nobody wanted to do anything about it.
Well, they're
until
not.
Now.
Well, they're doing it now. So you know, the main thing is that her physician has ordered the ultrasound. They're looking for blood flow because sometimes if there is a tumor that's there, the tumor would have more blood flow to it, and you're trying to look for things that might be suggestive of that. But there's other tests that they will do, likely other thyroid function tests. They may want to do a biopsy if they're suspicious about the nodule that's there. So there are a few things. There's also what's called there's a nuclear scan that they can do, which will help determine whether those nodules, we call them hot or cold nodules, and that will determine whether it's suspicious for tumors or whether it's just thyroid tissue that's more active or not. So there are a few extra things to do.
But I mean, is it a normal thing for someone to have numerous nodules or noids nodes or whatever they are in there and not, to be nothing?
Yes, you can have. You certainly can have nodules in the thyroid that are not going to cause any harm. But if you do find the nodules, you want to establish whether they are harmless or not. Because to just have it as a mystery means that the person may be at risk. You're better off knowing if this is actually something or not.
Yeah, there's one large one that's laying right on the right thyroid.
Right.
Would that damage or do any harm to a thyroid?
Well, usually the way you know whether it's damaging the thyroid or not is if it's affecting thyroid hormone levels. So if the nodules are destroying the gland and thyroid hormone levels are being affected, then you would know that it's causing a problem. Usually what they'll do is they'll just try and identify what the nodules are. And then once it is known, once there's a diagnosis of what they are, depending on that diagnosis, they can certainly answer the question about whether this is something that will cause harm to the thyroid over time. Whether it is a tumor, whether they need to do surgery, or whether they're just going to leave it alone. But it really depends on what they determine those nodules to be.
Okay. And really, basically, you're saying that they don't do a whole lot about them until such time as they start causing problems?
Correct. Usually, if you have benign nodules in the thyroid and you have normal thyroid function, you really want to stay away from doing any surgery because, again, whenever you do a procedure or ever offer a treatment, it's always a balance between what is the benefit of doing this versus what is the risk involved. And if you have a normal thyroid function and the nodules are not interfering with any other function and you've determined that those nodules are benign, usually you leave that person alone because the surgery itself is not going to make that person any better than what they are right now.
Well, excellent. That makes me feel a little bit... I'll explain it a little bit more to her and she won't be so, freaking out about it.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's it. That's all. I'm sorry we didn't get to everyone who was on the line today. You can try again. Are you here on Sunday?
Here on Sunday at 4:30. I have Dr. Yoni Friedhoff. From 4:30 till 6.
Weighty
answering
matters.
Questions and talking about weight and diet and evidence-based stuff, not the what we call chazarai that you get out there by people pushing stuff.
Okay. Look forward to that. Sunday, 4:30. Is that right, Barry?
It's at 4:30.
4:30. Okay. That's the Sunday House Call. Don't forget Health Headlines with Dr. Dworkin, 10 minutes to 7 during Madeley in the Morning. And in fact, Steve was back today.